buildings to avoid those kind of microclimate effects. And then we provided the plants for these sites. Each garden was each garden site was responsible for planting and obviously for ongoing maintenance of these gardens, for preparing the site. We were able to provide signage so that the purpose of the garden could be explained, and also the names of plants could be there in the garden. Data collection, each site is responsible for collecting data, and they really do it in a number of different ways. Some sites have one or two people that team up and they collect all the data, first bloom and full bloom, for each of the plants throughout the season. Others have volunteers sign up for specific weeks or for specific plants. My plant may be gold-tied forsythia. I have to find first bloom and full bloom for that plant, and then someone else comes in to track the phenological data for the next plant. In any event, all that data is submitted through our website, which we've had excellent feedback. It's very user-friendly. The volunteers can go right on there, put the date of bloom in. And they can do that weekly throughout the season, or they can save their data, you know, do a paper collection, which folks seem to like. They like to have a notebook of the data, and then they can come in at the end of the season and enter that onto the website. Training and follow-up are really key. We have a yearly phenology kickoff, usually in late March or April, where we have all of our cooperators come together. We usually have 80 to 100 people, which is, for us, really, really exciting. We have different speakers. We've had some talk about weed phenology, wildflower phenology, bird phenology. So try to give the volunteers the bigger picture of phenology. And then we talk about specific issues or challenges at each site. And this last spring, we had, we also have a lot of sharing among gardens, what they're doing, how they're teaching. And this this woman had developed a persona called Aunt Lil. And Aunt Lil, you can see she's wearing a shawl, which has the picture of a person's head for the phrenology part. And so each of those little lobes of the brain have one of our phrenology plants on it. So she comes dressed in her phenological garb, and she teaches weather lore to classes to help children learn about phenology. So very, very interactive, very interesting take on phenology. We received a grant in 2005 that allowed us to add perennials to these gardens. And our idea with the perennials was that these are accessible plants that home gardeners could grow. And so then our recommendations could be easily adapted to what's happening in the home garden. Again, we selected specific cultivars for each of these plants. And we tried to go as much as we could with plants that were perennial plants of the year. So these are, you know, pretty tried and true perennials that were easy to grow in a variety of garden locations. We did pare down the number of Asteraceae. We only have one composite flower, because the trick of when one flower is open versus the whole composite, and trying to, you know, we try to train master gardeners to understand that, but just to really physically be able to see that is a little challenging. We're fortunate enough to have a graduate student, Ashley Font, who's now working with the data. We have 3 years of the woody plant data, only 2 years on the perennial plant data. And some of the things she's been able to put together and mine from this data, and we're just getting these results back, but if you'll look here at this little dip, which is kind of interesting, around our coralverse crabapple, we had an extreme freeze situation in April last year, which is reflected in you know, which plants we were able to take data on. Another thing that we've really learned is that some plants are more suitable than others to collect phenology data, and we've learned our lesson with Potentilla and Rose of Sharon. If you grow those plants, you know that first bloom is pretty easy to detect, but as far as full bloom, they just kind of keep growing and blooming, and so it's much harder to put your hands around when those plants are in full bloom. And actually, as we've gone through the project, we've told our volunteers, you know, don't worry about Potentilla and Rose of Sharon for full bloom. Just omit that data. So some folks still try to put a date on that, and others just let it go. We're able to now start to compare the sequence of bloom, which is something that we wanted to be able to do. Is the sequence of bloom consistent from, say, Cincinnati to Columbus and north through Cleveland, or is there some variation? So here we have some annual data that compares 2005 to 2006 and 7 at Seacrest Arboretum. And then we're also able to look at other locations throughout the state. we were very interested in this idea of a phenological wave. We know just kind of anecdotally that from Cincinnati to where I am in Akron, it's about 10 days. I like being in Akron because I can see what problems are in Cincinnati, and I can seem really smart because I am getting people ready for what's coming our way. So we're trying to quantify then this phenological wave. How fast is bloom time progressing from the south to the north of the state? And then some things that are a little unexpected, if you look at the slope of the Miss Kim Lilac and the number of degree days required for first bloom, we have a decrease as the latitude increases. So something that's, you know, a little counterintuitive that's coming out of those data points. So what we've learned, the spring meeting is really popular both with Dan and myself and all of our volunteers. You know, you get stretched in a lot of different directions, you're doing a lot of different projects, and it can be hard to commit a lot of time and energy to any one of those. But when we get the room full of 80 or 100 Master Gardener volunteers who are excited to be there, they may have, you know, driven halfway across the state to spend their own time with us, it really gets us jazzed up about the project. And I think every year at the end, Dan looks at me and he says, you know, this thing really has legs, it's working. So that spring meeting is really essential. We found plant replacement to be a necessary evil, even though we don't have to have data points from each plant, from each garden every year. The cooperators really want to have a complete garden. They want to have all the plants there. And so lining up those replacements is a little problematic. We have to get around to different nurseries and go, you know, pick those up and put them in the truck and get them to Worcester and hope that they come pick them up when they say they're going to, or else we're stuck with a bunch of gold-tied forsythia that we're not sure what to do with because you can't really take it home. And anyway, so that plant replacement is a little problematic, but something that we've been committed to doing. A single location seems to work better than a scattered arrangement, and what I mean by this is at Dawes Arboretum, for example, the head of horticulture had a lot of these phenology plants already in the arboretum, and so he would make his rounds and check first bloom and full bloom for each of these plants, which over several years became really challenging for him just to find the time to get around to them. So he's elected to pull those plants together. He's now trying to find a private donor so that he can have a more interpretive phenology garden right there with all the plants together right outside of the horticulture office, so he's not driving around trying to take all that data. Multiple data collectors can be challenging, and you know this as you work with volunteers. Sometimes they do what they say they're going to do, and other times they don't. And our cooperators have definitely found that at various locations. Sometimes people don't come the week they say they're going to come, or they don't take data for the plant they say they are, or they take the data and they never submit it. So it seems to work better for one or two people to partner up on a garden, take all of that data and submit it, rather than, you know, some gardens have 12 or 15 people that they're trying to coordinate to collect and submit that data, and that's really problematic. As I mentioned, some plants are difficult to tell what the first bloom is, like those Asteraceae, and what full bloom is, like Rose of Sharon, and so we've learned that as we go that it's a little harder to work with. There's definitely a learning curve with the plant material. We've tried to have labels that go in the garden at each site, but there's still some challenges of helping our volunteers learn all the different perennials and woody plants. I mean, you know, if you work in horticulture, there's such a great variety out there, and even if we have a lot of knowledge in the room, there's still probably no one who knows all the different plants on first glance. So we've had to spend some time trying to bring everybody up to speed on learning those plants. The school sites have been problematic, and I'm kind of sorry to say that because I was really hoping that this would be a great way to have students collect data, enter that data on the website. It's real science. They can really see it happening. But really, all of our sites, we've either, you know, lost the teacher that was interested, or the volunteer has moved to another school, or we just don't have any successful school sites, which I was really hoping to see. And then we've learned things about individual plants, like the fact that deer love cutleaf elderberry, and it's a little hard to determine first bloom and full bloom if there are no blooms. So looking ahead, we are excited to be coming to the point where we can share our data with our cooperators. They're really excited to know what we're finding, with whether the sequence holds true. and what kinds of information we can offer them. We're also looking to develop interpretive materials so that as Master Gardeners are doing programs, a lot of them are training Master Gardeners, they're going out to the phenology garden and talking about phenology, we want to be able to offer them materials so that they can make pest recommendations, management and scouting recommendations based on the plants that are there in the garden. We are looking to continue the data collection at least through 2009, but our website can really stay up collecting data indefinitely, so it's something that really can go longer term. And then finally, we want to continue to foster this collaboration because we have a wonderful set of partners who are part of this. There's no way that Dan and I could even do a portion of what we're able to do thanks to the Master Gardeners and staff members at Arboretum and other locations who are submitting this data. So with that, I think I have a minute or so if anybody has any questions.
Use of perennials, having planted perennials and other research projects, I know the sequence of bloom is different the first year versus the second year. Like when they first established, they may bloom earlier or they may bloom later, depending on that kind of works. How are you adjusting to that?
Well, if you mean the first year planted, we planted everything in the spring. We didn't collect any data that year, so they all sat in the garden at that site for at least a year before that bloom data was collected.
Mulching and some of the other cultural practices with garbage land that can vary from sites, do you standardize that at all your sites? Is that part of the training that you do in the beginning?
Okay, so the question was, did we do do we have any standard recommendations about mulching or maintenance? And we didn't. Really, our feeling was that the phenology is going to hold true no matter what the mulching practices are or the pruning practices. And so we left that up to each individual site. Yes?
Did you standardize the planting plan for all of these gardens, anticipating that if you have a mixture of weed plants as they grow, they might change the light exposure for other plants?
Okay, so the question was, did we keep a standard planting plan or do we leave it up to each site? And we really did leave it up to each site to determine, again, whether they wanted everything in one garden or wanted it scattered throughout the demonstration garden. With our goal being 5 years, I mean, our star magnolia will eventually shade out the hellebores or what have you, but at this point they're all pretty dinky. So early on it's not an issue, but certainly down the road it could be a concern. Yes?
Have you done any comparisons or correlations to Donald Warden's work in Illinois?
Well, it's interesting because some of our Master Gardeners know that work and they are excited. You know, they bring in that book and they want to talk about coincidence. And we haven't. That's a good point. We haven't really looked at coinciding our results with what was found there. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you.
When you've got a very complex pest problem, host plant resistance offers a fairly simple solution to that problem. So that's why it's so attractive, particularly for insect-transmitted viruses. Now, the topic that I have today is host plant resistance to tomato spotted wilt virus and thrips in tomato and pepper. Tomato spotted wilt virus is a tossable virus that's strictly transmitted by thrips. It has a fairly complex relationship to both the thrips and the plant. And because of that, host plant resistance has really been a godsend for us in tomato and pepper. Okay, what I'd like to do is to kind of give you a background on the relationship of the virus to the thrips and to the plant, just to show you how complex it is. And then go right into the results from a 2006 host plant resistance trial on both pepper and tomato, and then a follow-up in 2007 with more lines that we looked at for both pepper and tomato, and then give a brief summary at the end. Now, tospa virus in the southeast has caused tremendous amount of damage. It's in peppers and tomatoes alone, I would estimate about 10 to 20 $1 million in loss on an average year for that area. The tomato spotted wilt virus generally occurs from North Florida through Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and that area is a very hot zone for damage due to tospa viruses. Now, one of the things that makes this particular problem difficult to manage with any other tactic is the fact that you've got more than one, number one, you've got more than one vector species. Western flower thrips is a known vector of tomato spotted wilt virus, and in our area, Franklinella fusca or tobacco thrips is also a very good vector. The virus needs to be acquired by first and second instars. It's not transovarial. You don't have the virus being passed on from the adult to the young, so the thrips have to land on the plant. They transmit the virus to the plant. They lay eggs on that plant, and then the first and second instars acquire the virus. If they become viriliferous, they are viriliferous through their lifespan. And so the adults that emerge out of that population, they can move on into our host plants in the spring crop. Now, we've tried a number of things to try to predict the intensity of the virus, you know, going into the spring crop, but the bottom line is, you know, you don't know easily. You don't easily know the percentage of viriliferous thrips in a population in the spring, so it's very difficult to predict that type of risk. And when you have that situation, it's nice to have something like host plant resistance that's in place that can reduce damage to the from the virus. So just to give you a little brief background as to how we evaluated host plant resistance, I think it's important to know a couple of different things. Number one, it's important to know how the virus is being transmitted to the crop, what's the consequences of early transmission versus late, and then how does the plant respond? Particularly, I'm going to focus on tomato in this little discussion.